This week on Your Western Context, a Rogers outage shows the need for telecom stability. Jean Charest promises a fair deal for Alberta, and the Premier Summit provides no fix for health care. Also, Trudeau's internet censorship bill, C-11, gets opposed by the U.S. This is Western Context, episode 277, recorded Friday, July 15th, 2022, a leadership outage. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are back this week after a bit of a short summer break, but nonetheless, the news has been stacking up, and we have quite a bit to get through, and unlike last weekend, most of you guys listening to this weekend will actually be able to hear the podcast if you're on a certain wireless network out there.
Yes, indeed. It was very interesting to see such a failure of the internet and telecommunications system, but we have that story and more, of course, coming up that the media has not really been talking about as much as they should have, and certainly from different angles that have not been covered. So we are here this week, as always, to talk about the news that the media does not, and to remove some of that bias and sensationalism that we always see in our day-to-day lives whenever we consume the news media.
And with that, if you're joining us for the first time, Western Context is the podcast that aims to remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media, and in doing so, we hope to provide all the information and context necessary to put you, our listeners, on the right side of the news. And if you want to follow along, you can find our full show notes at westerncontext.ca. And we're going to start with the story about just looking into just what happened with the Rogers Network last Friday, tailing into Saturday.
Yes, last Friday and into the rest of the weekend as well in some parts. Canadians were shocked when Rogers, which is one of Canada's three biggest telecoms companies, experienced widespread internet and services outages. Now, the Canadian economy and everyday life, of course, is tethered to our communications networks. And when they go down, like Rogers did for most of the day on Friday, there's no real universal plan B to keep widely used and vital services online, and the repercussions are quite serious whenever this happens. After all, even if you aren't a Rogers customer, pain was felt. 911 services went down amongst most cities across the country, which caused untold harm. Debit transactions were unavailable as Interac and most of the small concentrated number of banks in Canada also use Rogers infrastructure to operate, which meant that people needing funds from their account, and if they didn't have credit cards as a backup, or even if they used Rogers credit cards as well, those were down. And a lot of people couldn't access their online transfers or even go to the ATM and get cash. Now, government services, including the CRTC, which runs the telecoms companies and regulates based on them, on how they're able to do, even their services were down. And this also included the Arrive Can app, which forced travelers to rely on paper copies of their information when they were arriving in Canada. And often this would be after the flights got underway, and this would be a very big issue if people got to Canada and they didn't have paper copies of their information, especially their vaccination records. Because of the travel requirements that the government put in place, this meant that a lot of people were stuck in the airports and not able to progress further into Canada. Now, part of the problem is that whether it's in our business or personal lives, we often rely on one company for all of our telecom services, which is something that these companies like Rogers, Bell, and TELUS offer as an incentive for slightly lower prices. Now, people may wish to reconsider bundling all their services with one company, because if you're all in one and that one goes down, you're really quite isolated, especially for those working from home full time or for people who rely on their telecom services to get their products out there, which, you know, we as podcasters rely on our internet services to be able to do that and to record. And that's not necessarily an option in many parts of the country, especially rural parts, that only really have one or maybe two options to be able to access the internet. Economist Dan Ciriac described the outage as a wake-up call for Canada, and he said, quote, "We have become remarkably fragile because of the rapid pace of innovation and the rapid pace of implementation of new techniques and new forms of technology." And he says that Canada's infrastructure has not really kept up with the innovation because of the lack of incentive for the companies to do so, as there is very little competition, as I mentioned, in many parts of the country. It means that these companies aren't forced to innovate or deliver better products for their customers. Now, businesses relying on wireless networks may want to consider diversifying their infrastructure as well, added David Soberman, who is a marketing professor at the Rotman School of Management at the University of Toronto. And he said, quote, "If cashless payment systems are based on one network, you may find that some companies basically contract with two different wireless or internet suppliers so that they have one option if the other fails. But not all companies can afford all of those backups. And as a result, many companies, especially small businesses, were forced to only accept cash, including one event that was being held that touted themselves as being a cashless festival. And they weren't able to actually accept money from their customers because they had no backups in place for their card infrastructure. And, well, they weren't accepting cash, so many people didn't bring cash to buy their goods with. So it really does show how cash can be the universal money transfer option, because it's something that you don't need technology to work with. Now, federal government critics are also demanding an investigation into the Rogers service disruption. Conservative MP Michelle Rempel-Garner said, quote, "Given the critical infrastructure that's affected and that the CRTC itself is affected, the cause of the Rogers outage should be immediately explained." And she was calling for an emergency parliamentary committee meeting to make sure that it doesn't happen again. Because, after all, Rogers did have an outage like this almost a year ago as well. Now, although the CRTC has declared broadband internet a basic telecommunications service, it's not a utility like water or power, which are mostly run by crown corporations or quasi-crown corporations. Soberman said that the government may want to consider treating the wireless and internet services in a similar fashion to ensure that there is limited disruption to business and vital services like 911. There could be a means of other wireless or internet companies stepping in to mitigate a disruption like this, he suggested. He said, quote, "The internet is providing an infrastructure that is as important as the electrical system, as important as the water, and certainly as important as the postal system. You might want to make some kind of law or regulation that would ensure that this service is provided all the time to people, even if one of the suppliers has a problem." Now, the CRTC does have rules regarding the telecom networks, ensuring that cell phone users are still able to contact 911 even without wireless service. In a statement, the regulator said that it had asked Rogers to prioritize measures to, quote, "ensure that the 911 calls from cell phones can be completed." Of course, this was something that was disrupted during the outage. Now, Canadians of all political stripes can agree that the concentrated power of our very few telecoms companies, otherwise known as an oligarchy, has not been good for consumers, and political parties of all stripes have let Canadians down in letting the problem continue to get worse. We already pay among the highest rates in the world for phone and internet plans, and now we can't even rely on the infrastructure of basic services to work if we're not even a customer of one of the companies involved. This is a problem that has just gotten worse, and it's time for a federal government that takes these issues seriously.
And this is something we'll also touch on in our firing line as well, and it comes down to a core issue of the government by and large in terms of the buttons and levers that are being pushed and pulled, that they don't understand technology in general. And because of that, they haven't been able to really, in effect, grow out the infrastructure that's needed to provide a robust network across the country. Now, you can ask Rogers or Telus or Bell about their own network, and they'll say that they have guidelines in place ensuring that their network can't go down due to one fault. But what Rogers has said as a result of this outage is that it was caused by maintenance. Initially, the thought might have been that it could have been some form of cyber attack, but they later on, I think it was Monday, probably, they said that it was caused by maintenance, and that raises even more eyebrows if it's able to, if a maintenance period is able to knock off that much of the Canadian network space. And of course, we're not just talking about regular everyday people accessing the network. We're talking about businesses on the other side and emergency service providers that build their infrastructure to rely on one provider as well. So it really should be a wake-up call for everybody involved on this front, both on Rogers' side to ensure that if something like this were to happen, maybe there's a way that their cellular customers can easily move on to the Telus or Bell network. Because back in the day, in the late 90s and early 2000s, cell phones were actually designed to respond to different frequencies. And people might remember this, that when the first iPhone came out in the U.S. before it even got to Canada, that if you were in the U.S., you had to buy one iPhone if you were on AT&T and then get a different one if you were on Verizon. And that's how these networks were designed. And there needs to be an awakening that the network should be completely interoperable so that if needed, one of the others, Telus, Bell, or Shaw, can provide fillover coverage to ensure that everybody on the network is actually able to have the internet access that they need at the end of the day.
Yes, and this isn't even the first time in this past month that these services have gone down as well. During a major shooting at a BMO Bank in Victoria earlier this month, services in the area were disrupted, and it caused a lot of problems with people trying to call 911 and finding that they couldn't. And this app actually happened to Telus customers, and it was found after the fact that a major cell phone tower that was put up by Telus that was servicing the area was faulty, and that it needed work on it to actually operate properly. So there were dozens of Telus customers that were understandably wanting to call into 911 after hearing gunshots in a place in an area that doesn't normally hear it, and they weren't able to do so. And there was also problems at the Royal Jubilee Hospital in downtown Victoria that were preparing for the possibility of having a lot of shooting victims after hearing of the news of the shooting at the bank. Thankfully, of course, it was only the responding police officers that got shot, and no civilians were harmed in the end. And the hospital didn't have to prepare for too much, but there was problems with the telecoms at the hospital as well in this area. So I think that that's something that having just one provider is going to be something that people are going to have to think about as they go forward, because as these providers have interrupted service, this is going to be something that's going to cause a huge impact on everyday life and for things like emergency services that really need 911 services to be able to happen. There were some municipalities that were setting up email lines, and this is just something that you shouldn't see in a first world country like Canada. And unfortunately, it's another problem with our infrastructure, is that it's built on a house of cards that will fall if one company goes down. And I think that's something that really should be looked at a bit more. And it's something that I think the federal government over the past 5 years has not really addressed quite well in Canada. They've certainly had addressing internet availability in smaller communities. But what happens when that availability goes down? Well, we saw a little bit of it that last Friday.
Yeah, and this is, of course, a huge wake-up call to everybody involved in this. And that's one thing that hopefully won't be lost as we move past this, because the core problem was, of course, not being able to access the internet that day. But we need to make sure that the media covers the ensuing reasons why and what the aftermath is going to be with that. And that's what we do here each and every week at Western Context. And if you want to help us do that, you can check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/Western Context. And there we offer three tiers of support, starting at $2 a month, where you can help us remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media. For $5 a month, you can continue to help us do that and have your name read out on the podcast if you want. And for $10 a month, you can become a Western Context insider and gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production and show notes throughout the entire week. Now, when we reach $30 a month in contributions, patrons will receive an exclusive monthly news article expanding on topical stories of the month, and this article will continue to provide the context and information you've come to expect from us. At $60 a month, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month, where we reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and provide opinion on where affairs are headed next. And we also do have an option to make a one-time contribution as well via PayPal, which you can learn more about at westerncontext.ca/support. So we're going to move to Alberta right now and talk about what's happening in the province in relation to the federal Conservative leadership race, because we're now less than 2 months away from when the Conservative Party will choose their next leader. And since we last dipped into the race and before that, our leadership showcase, the party has lost one of its top candidates that we covered in that leadership showcase in Patrick Brown, who has been disqualified from the race. Now, it appears as though that Brown set up an arrangement for a third-party company to pay the wages of some campaign staffers, and this is a rule violation for the party. And if it's proven true, it's even a rule violation for Elections Canada law, which is a pretty big deal when you look at what has been happening in this country and in general in relation to political transparency. Now, the Brown campaign issued a statement that, in their view, if Patrick Brown is unable to compete in the race, his supporters should vote for Jean Charest. And that's what we're going to pick up this week's story here with, because you may have noticed I called this an Alberta story, and that's because the Calgary Stampede is happening, and Jean Charest spoke directly to Albertans last week. Now, this is, of course, an interesting topic to cover because many, of course, see Jean Charest as the legacy of the former Progressive Conservative Party, and we all know what happened to the Progressive Conservatives in Alberta and the West after the Mulroney government. Now, Charest said that if he is elected Prime Minister, he would develop a new equalization system for the province, in particular, that Alberta generates a lot of wealth for all of the provinces, so it deserves to have an equalization formula that's fair to Alberta, he said in one of his interviews. Now, also in the interview that was exclusive to the Western Standard, which most media did not pick up on, Jean Charest said that there will also be an Alberta Accord focused on equalization, as well as allowing the province to implement many of the Fair Deal panel recommendations that has been talked about in the province in late 2019 and early 2020. These include things like the provincial police force, as well as offering what rights Quebec has in terms of more control over the province's immigration and a closer look at trade deals for the province. Now, he also addressed polling that showed that up to a third of Albertans would support seceding from Canada and put that blame categorically at Justin Trudeau's feet, saying that Alberta went through a tough time from 2014 onward, and there was no acknowledgement or recognition of that. It's the federal government's job to keep the country together and make sure that every province is part of what we are planning and developing, and that's not happening with the Trudeau government. And that's our quote of the week this week, because it underscores the huge gulf in differences between the political parties of even what a Jean Charest-led Conservative Party of Canada would do versus what the Justin Trudeau Liberals have done over the last 7 years. Now, if we go further into the interview and what was perhaps most interesting about Charest's approach, despite him not being able to set media cycles and set a narrative in terms of actually getting the stories that he needs out there to be successful in the race and make sure that he wouldn't be derailed if he were to become leader, because that's one of the big issues of the Charest campaign that has plagued former leaders Andrew Scheer and Aaron O'Toole. And we're seeing this again this week because he this week proposed a coalition between Quebec and Alberta that effectively says that the two provinces could set the direction of the country together and effectively bypass what Ontario, or what the will of Ontario, wants to do. And for people who are familiar with the 1980s, we'll know that what Charest is referring to is a long-gone Mulroney coalition of the West, the Quebec Nationalists, and rural parts of Ontario. This has happened in the past, and it's a real method of building support in the country, which should not be discounted. But the media conveniently ignores any notion of bringing back such a coalition. And this is very similar, of course, to what happened in the 2016 U.S. election, when many thought the blue wall of Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania would never budge, but they did. And that leads us to ask here at Western Context, and we've asked before, maybe an alliance between Quebec and Alberta in terms of policy isn't too far off, and maybe that could also build an electoral coalition as well that we haven't seen since the 1980s. And it's very shocking to see the media ignoring this, because if you look at what the premiers of the two provinces have been doing, Premier Jason Kenney and Premier François Legault, they've worked together on bringing the provinces closer, but no federal party has sought to capitalize that on that or bring Alberta to the national table with Quebec yet. Now, with this, it's important to note for those listening to our show this week that, including those who may be Conservative Party members or those who aren't, or we're effectively looking at a different phase of the leadership race now, a phase where candidates will try to secure votes and move votes and secure those second slot choices, since the party uses a ranked balloting system. And because of that, the story underlined here is twofold. First, Alberta and Quebec are similar, and the media conveniently ignores that most of the time. And the federal parties, all of them, don't presently take this into account, and it's something that should be eye-opening for many. Secondly, for Conservative Party members and for people who have become disillusioned with the party due to the persistent wedging and divisions of Justin Trudeau and the Liberals, they need to know that any federal party leader seeking to not divide Canadians would be better than our current administration in terms of alleviating those feelings, and especially those feelings of separatism that do come up from time to time in the province. Now, as they say, of course, the more things change, the more they stay the same. And if Jean Charest wins, he could be very well on the path to reviving a coalition from the past featuring Alberta and Quebec that could surprise everybody because of the media's lack of coverage on this file.
Yes, I think that the similarities between Alberta and Quebec cannot be understated, especially to those who have visited both provinces and have talked to both citizens from either province, because there is actually a very strong independent streak in both of those provinces and a strong wish for both provinces to be treated more fairly amongst the coalition of provinces that make up the country of Canada. And I think that that's something that really doesn't get much coverage in the media, mostly because they're focused on the wedge tactics that Justin Trudeau has used over the past 5 years that have pitted Quebec against Alberta. And certainly, there hasn't been much love lost in the past between the West and Quebec, but right now it seems that it comes down to Ontario that is the real decider in the federal government race. And right now, they've been voting quite overwhelmingly Liberal in the last few elections. And I think that that's something that also doesn't get much coverage as well. Now, if the Conservatives want to win, they're going to have to make inroads into many different places of the country. But, you know, they're not that far away, given their results back in 2017, as well as 2019. So I think that is something that should be looked at, especially if they get a strong leader that can appeal to many of the issues that Canadians are feeling right now, many of which, of course, we've discussed on the podcast in the past. And I think that that's something that really doesn't get discussed in the media because they don't really want to talk about that very much. They're focused on other things, and this story kind of flies completely under the radar. And, you know, this is something that Charest has been talking about, and a Charest-led government would be better for the West, better for Alberta, and I think better for Canada than what we have right now. But, you know, that's up to people to decide, and for Conservative Party members who will be voting in the Conservative leadership race in a couple months, you know, that's something that they're going to have to decide when they go to the ballot.
Indeed, indeed. And so many of the things have been glossed over in the media. And as we said in the story, a good amount of discussion actually just focuses on the wedge issues that are happening. But there is national unity at the premier's table, in particular on healthcare funding. And that's where we're going next.
Yes, and as we mentioned on our last show, all of the premiers had a two-day summit in Victoria earlier this week, and the big topic on everyone's minds was healthcare, specifically our crumbling and broken public healthcare system that is barely staying functional after 3 years of pain. Now, anyone who says that Canada's healthcare system is the greatest in the world has clearly never actually had to access it, because we've had long wait times in hospitals, long wait times for procedures, and even over the past couple of years of the dark times, many different canceled procedures, especially a lack of preventative measures in healthcare that could stop major issues from cropping up if they're detected sooner. And this is something that has been going on for quite some time now, but it's just been slowly and steadily getting worse and worse as the years go on. Now, BC Premier John Horgan, who chaired the meeting, summed up the provincial government's position by saying that it was up to the federal government to provide more money in healthcare transfers. He said in his usual casual speech that, quote, 24 months ago, we were collaborating in an unprecedented way. There was unprecedented collaboration of the federal government was right there with us, and we applauded that engagement. And now, 8 months later, we're exchanging notes through the media. Where did the love go? Everything was so fine, and then it wasn't. Now, everything was so fine and then it wasn't could be the tagline for the past 3 years, but yes, the provinces do have jurisdiction over healthcare responsibilities, but the federal government has allocated resources to the provinces known as the healthcare transfer that makes up about 22% of the cost, and about 13% comes from income and corporate taxes to fund health services directly that the federal government has allowed provincial governments to collect for that purpose. Now, the federal government says that when the CHT and those tax points are combined with the money that Ottawa spends on bilateral deals for long-term care, home care, mental health, and some other services, the portion of health care spending covered by the federal government came closer to 38.5%. But at the end of the day, while the provinces and federal government quibble over math and tax numbers, Canadians really just want a system that works. And every week there are new stories about seriously ill people who are ignored by the hospitals or left in hallways or emergency waiting rooms without receiving care or even just an acknowledgement that they're there. And some of them have died as a result. And some people have had very preventative issues just get worse because they can't find a doctor or they can't receive medical care. And that's something that has been a major issue for some time, but it's only been getting worse and worse. Now, in the meantime, the BC Court of Appeal released its judgment on an appeal to a landmark decision back in 2020 upholding the public healthcare system. A constitutional challenge was being appealed by private healthcare advocate Dr. Brian Day, who is the owner of Vancouver's Cambie Surgery Clinic, center. Day was appealing a 2020 BC Supreme Court decision dismissing his claims that patients have the charter right to pay for private care when wait times in the public system are too long. Now, Friday morning this week, a panel of three justices at the BC Court of Appeal, which is Canada's or BC's highest court, rejected Dr. Day's argument that a lower court judge had made critical errors of fact in denying his constitutional challenge. Now, in their majority reasons for judgment, Chief Justice Robert Bowman and Justice David Harris wrote that while long wait times for treatment have denied some patients their charter rights to life and security of the person, those violations are permitted under the principles of fundamental justice. Now, the justices said that the laws that Day objects to are meant to ensure equitable provision of health care and prevent the creation of a two-tier system where access to potentially life-saving treatment depends on wealth. Now, the judgment says, quote, "We accept the personal interest British Columbians have in avoiding a lengthy wait when they do have resources to avail themselves of private care to avoid an increased risk of death. We do not minimize the seriousness of that issue, but we also recognize that the objective of the Medicare Protection Act includes ensuring that individuals without the ability to pay are not thereby deprived of medically necessary care." Now, the third appeal court judge, Justice Laurie Ann Fenlon, concurred with the decision to dismiss Day's appeal, but found that long wait times in the public system are, quote, "grossly disproportionate to the objectives of BC's law." She wrote, quote, "A system that provides care 3 years after it is needed could not, except by the most strained definition, be described as a system that provides access to medical care." However, she did say that this violation of the principles of fundamental justice is justified under Section 1 of the Charter, which allows for, quote, "reasonable limits prescribed by law as can be demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society." Now, Fenlon wrote that while the current system prolongs suffering and causes harm for those who would be able to pay for private treatment, she had to consider the common good. Because she wrote, quote, "The negative consequences of striking the impugned provisions and allowing private care would cause those who could not avail themselves of private care, the most vulnerable in society, to wait even longer for care, thereby potentially increasing their risk of harm beyond that we have found to exist under the current regime." Now, the appeal court judgment closes another chapter in a legal saga that began in 2009, but the story is likely far from over. Day has long said that he expects to fight his case all the way up to the Supreme Court of Canada. Now, advocates of private health care or a two-tier system in Canada will no doubt be disappointed by the ruling, along with the Premier Summit, because neither decision will really lead to much change for our broken system. And no one has any real solution at the moment, and as the boomer generation continues to age, more and more strain will be put on our system. It's up to our governments, both provincial and federal, to fix these issues, but none have really stepped up to the plate.
And this is an interesting story, because on one hand you have the premier's meeting, and on the other hand you have this ruling regarding healthcare in terms of private pay for access. And the problem with this ruling is that it is playing directly into the hands of the advocates of the public healthcare system in our country. Because if you look at what the typical argument is, that if you go into a two-tiered healthcare system, you're going to, in effect, have doctors who are going to find it more compelling to practice privately, which decreases the number of doctors who are practicing publicly. And that is something that could very well happen with this, but we have to understand that taking a direct carbon copy approach of the American healthcare system isn't going to necessarily work for Canada. What private healthcare advocates need to do instead in the country is instead focus on private healthcare models that we see in Europe. Focus on moving the non-critical procedures, or at least having an option to move them, to private clinics. And eventually, one step follows the next, you could wind up with a healthcare system in the country that has, of course, publicly funded hospitals, but you could also have in tandem operating privately funded hospitals where the person who is able to decide where they want to go in that system would, of course, have all of that money, or rather the health insurance provided by the government, and then they would choose where they go, where they're going to get the best service. And if you look at what happens in Europe, this is very similar to what we see in European countries like Switzerland, who do have a hybrid private public healthcare system. And the unfortunate side of this debate is that whenever this debate comes to Canada, it immediately gets put up and compared against to the American system, which isn't necessarily going to be the best way to win the hearts and minds of people who want a good healthcare system in the country. It can't be 100% focused on copying the American system. It has to be focused instead on delivering services privately, but still having an option to have the bulk of it publicly funded with options on the side for private insurance, as already exists in this country for things like dental and eye care and podiatry, amongst other things.
Yes, I think that's something that we're seeing a lot of roadblocks on, and certainly the federal NDP were wanting an expansion of the public healthcare system with things like dental and other sorts of care being put under the umbrella of the public system. But right now, the public system can't even handle what it has, and there are major problems, not only with staffing shortages, with lots of doctors experiencing brain drain where they're leaving Canada because they can't, there's better options just to our neighbors to the south. And who can really blame them when they're getting so much more for practicing down there than they can up here? And I think that we're also seeing many other systemic issues where there's a lot of healthcare administration, where a lot of the money that is being spent by the provinces gets tied up in administration, and not enough of it goes to the actual healthcare that's being provided from nurses or doctors. And there's of course a lot of bureaucracy that gets involved in it as well. There really needs to be a government that looks at the system as a whole and sees what they can do to really fix the system, because the courts have shown that they're unwilling to accept any intrusion of private healthcare into the system. And while the Liberals and NDP sort of agreement is hinged upon the changes to the healthcare system, there really hasn't been any movement on that file either. And I think that this is something that the media really doesn't talk very much about, is that a lot of the parties have their own ideas on healthcare, but nothing is changing. And if nothing changes, the problem is just going to continue to get worse. And I think whether you're a private healthcare advocate or you're a fan of the public healthcare model, this is something that both of those can agree on, is that if nothing is done, then it'll just get worse. And I think that for people who have to access the healthcare system, which really should be everybody, is something that should worry all of Canadians.
Yeah, and much like in the previous story, it's an exact same carbon copy of there being discussions of things happening, but at the end of the day, nothing happens, and that's why we said in the previous story, the more things change, the more they stay the same, and we're going to see if that's happening with our next story as well as we move into our firing line. And the past Parliament saw Bill C-11 die when Parliament was dissolved for the election which regulated internet content streaming. The bill was since resurrected and passed in the new session. And C-11 was something that we talked about quite a lot here on the podcast, and it faced criticism from many online content creators, online streaming services, and now most notably from the U.S. government of all things. And our discussion on the successor is what this story is going to be about, what follows C-11. But it's first worth noting that C-11 has actually become a trade issue between the government of Canada and the Biden administration in the U.S. Now, the issue is that the Biden administration is, of course, looking at C-11's ability to regulate user-generated content, which no country has done. Now, the new NAFTA replacement called the CUSMA in Canada, or USMCA in the US, features a clause requiring non-discriminatory treatment of digital products. And you can probably see where this is going from here. Now, looking at the trade agreement, Canada can, of course, violate these clauses for cultural reasons, but with that, the U.S. would be within their own right to levy, as the law says, measures of equivalent commercial effect, which is complex trade language for tariffs, which then could be put on industries like the dairy industry, the timber industry, the automobile industry, or any industry that trades heavily between Canada and the U.S. Now, this hasn't, of course, stopped the government of Canada from charging forward and plotting what happens next after C-11, but Heritage Minister Pablo Rodriguez struck an expert advisory group on online safety, and that group held meetings between April 9th and June 3rd. Now, according to Blacklock's reporter, publication outlet operating out of Ottawa, which covers Parliament Hill primarily, they got access to these meetings that show that the next step was devising methods of censoring internet content that was deemed hurtful. Now, it's going to be moving into a gray area, because expanding on what hurtful could mean is a very difficult thing. It could mean anything from fraud to cyberbullying to mass sharing of traumatic incidences, defamatory content, propaganda, false advertising, and even misleading political communications. Now, the first half of these makes sense, and an argument can be made, but drilling down further, the panel says that disinformation was like pollution in our country. And we need to be 100% clear that the internet of today requires a subjective lens on what is harmless fun and what could be seen as disinformation in the eyes of a state, or even state-sponsored disinformation. A meme, which has been used as our word of the week before, which is a funny image, most oftentimes used to clarify a political point, can be seen as disinformation by some, but for others it's just a bit of harmless fun. And that's where the real discussion begins, because last July, the Heritage Department proposed creating a digital safety commissioner, which would be responsible for hearing anonymous complaints. Now, censorship by committee, as it is said, following the meeting minutes, could potentially include things like Facebook posts, Twitter posts, video games, listings on Amazon or Airbnb, and other private and direct messages that are sent on the internet. Factoring all this in, this means that any company that is operating in Canada would be on the hook for providing this data and would need to be able to access it and give it to law enforcement if they asked for it. What this means is that it would need to be stored unencrypted. And this takes us to the encryption battle. Encryption is what happens when data on a digital device is stored in such a way that it can't be read without applying an encryption key, whether that be a password or some other form of key. Most generally on the internet in this day and age, encryption is open source, which means that everybody can have it and use it if they want to. And if things are able to be snooped upon by the government, the bad actors will go deeper and find different sources of encryption that the government can't see through. As an example of this, if the government were to say that all direct messages sent on, say, Apple's iMessage were to be accessible if the government wanted them, then what would happen after that is that Apple would, in effect, need to store and provide the encryption keys to everybody's iMessage account if the government were to ask for it. And the more keys you store and the more options you provide to undoing that encryption, the less bulletproof that encryption becomes, degrading security and privacy for everybody, and it will have the side effect of forcing any potential bad actors to go deeper. Now, of course, people will point to hate speech and whether or not that should be regulated on the internet, and that's a perfectly legitimate discussion to have, but it's important to note that hate speech has been illegal under the Criminal Code of Canada since the year of 1970. Now, if there's going to be one light of hope in this story, is that the panel does distinguish an area of gray zone content that they call awful but lawful, and they say it's a unique challenge and going to present a unique challenge to police this content. But there were also those on the panel who questioned what the limit on freedom of expression should be on the internet in Canada. Now, when asked about all the information gathered, Rodriguez said that the government will, quote, take that information, work on a bill, and table it as soon as possible. Now, governments have a historically bad record of working with the internet, and even more so when it comes to matters of encryption and anything remotely technical, as we see in our internet infrastructure across this country. And just because of the current arrangement in Parliament, there's a huge possibility that in the effort of not triggering an election this fall, such a bill could pass easily with support of the NDP. Now, Parliament will resume in September, and should such a bill be introduced, we'll have coverage when it does and what its contents actually look like, and whether or not it has the potential to cause any international trade disputes as already happened with C-11, or anything that could potentially happen that's worse.
Yes, we're seeing that C-11 has many more problems attached to it than ever seen before. And if the U.S. government is taking issue with it, that's cause for concern for the Trudeau government, considering that they've already heard from many Canadians that have not been a fan of the C-11 bill and the very draconian measures that it would take place that would transform how Canadians are able to actually view and access the internet and what they're able to see online. And I think that we'll see if the Canadian government listens to the U.S. government on this issue, because generally if they've received opposition from Canadian groups, that's something that they haven't taken into account. But generally things change if the U.S. tends to get involved on this. And I think that if it has problem for tariffs and the trade industry, that might be something that gets the Trudeau government's attention on this. And I think when it comes down to it, Bill C-11 is going to cause issues for Canadians, but it's also going to cause issues for Canada. And I think this is something that really should be can't be understated enough because, or is understated and can't be overstated enough, because it's something that will fundamentally change that into a place that we haven't really seen before. And it's going to put the Canadian internet regulation on par with places like Iran or North Korea or China. And I think that that's something we really shouldn't be taking cues from. And whether or not Trudeau believes that that's something that the government should be in control of or not, well, you know, it's the proof is in the pudding in what he and his government decides to prioritize on at this time when there are many other issues in Canada that really need addressing.
Yeah, and it underscores that huge gulf that exists between the Prime Minister, the Cabinet, and the elected MPs about what Canadians are truly feeling and how they feel and what the general mood of the country is going to be as we move further and further away from the pandemic, and what the government seems to want to focus on. It seems to be 100% pandemic still, and we'll have to wait and see if these issues that are so important that were presented this week are further swept under the rug, or if the media is going to actually highlight them. But with that, I think we can move on to our word of the week.
Yes, our word of the week this week is outage, which is a period of time when a service is not available. And certainly there's been many outages we've seen over the past couple weeks, but the biggest one, of course, being the Rogers outage. And of course, you could apply outage to the healthcare story, where there's been certainly quite a bit of outages when it comes to accessing healthcare, not only for your own family doctor, or even in clinics, but the hospitals themselves, which have been operating under a great strain. And I think that that's something that we've seen a lot in Canada these past couple months, not only in the past week or so. And that's why outage is a good word of the week this week.
Yeah, and of course, that's what we could also be seeing on the internet in terms of if the government effectively decides that providers need to be able to provide all the details of what somebody is saying or some doing on their service, that those services might just choose to shut down instead, creating a different kind of outage. So outage definitely makes sense with the highly technical nature of what we saw this week on Western Context. But of course, if you want full show notes or supplementals for any of these stories that we talked about, you can find those at westerncontext.ca. You can also subscribe to the podcast on any number of podcast listeners out there. Just visit westerncontext.ca/subscribe. We're on all of them, from Apple to Google to Pocket Cast to Spotify and more. westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And of course, with that, we're also on social media, on Twitter and Facebook at Western Context, where we share the stories of the week and our shows. And with that being said, we'll see you next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll be sure to look through all the stories that the mainstream media has talked about and a lot that they haven't talked about, in uncovering the angles and the true stories of what is actually going on in Canada and why that matters to you. Whether in print, radio, TV, or online, we will find them and we will give you the context needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. So with that said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.